first thank my dear friend, Reb David, for that very moving eulogy, but I can wait. I am extremely happy to be here. You have to realize under what circumstances I'm here. I am sorry for upsetting your schedule. I arrived in this country this morning at about 5 o'clock, 4:30 in the morning. And my last night, which was a few more hours than our regular last night was, I gave a shiur in Bnei Brak and then in Netanya and then left to the airport. And this morning I gave a shiur in Flatbush and then spent 3 hours in the snow, 20 miles an hour, getting here. But it's my pleasure to be here. Firstly, it's my pleasure to be here because I rarely say no to any invitation that I'm giving from NCSY. I consider NCSY a very, very important organization, and anyone who is associated with is an Adam Gadol, and you don't say no to big people. So therefore I'm here. That's the first reason. The second reason, the invitation to come here came through my dear friends, Dr. and Mrs. Lukens. And since Dr. Lukens has told you that he knows me for a long, long time, he also knows a lot about me. And I rarely say no to anything that Dr. Lukens asks me for fear of what will be the reprisal. And lastly, I learned from my Rebbe of blessed memory, Rabbi Mordechai Gifter, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, that when somebody does something right, you're supposed to tell them. When the daughters of Tzlofcha asked a very good question, so Moshe Rabbeinu was instructed not only to answer their question, but to tell them, Kein benos slavcha dobros. They said something substantial, something right. Let them know. They said, did something good. They asked a good question. When somebody does something right and does something good, you're supposed to let them know. You're supposed to congratulate them. So I came here to tell you, you did something good. This time of year, a little free time, and to use that free time to come to a Yarchei Kala and to sit and learn Torah is something very, very good. And something that you deserve to be congratulated for, and it was worth traveling 3 hours to tell you, Yashar Koach. I rarely have a problem if people fall asleep while I'm speaking. I feel that that is a chesed that I can do for people. However, I have yet to fall asleep when I'm speaking. Tonight may be the first. At this point in time, I'm not exactly sure where I am or even if I am, which was complicated even more this morning when I got off the plane. A young woman came over to me and said, has anyone ever told you how strongly you resemble Rabbi Lev? That moment I had to pinch myself to find out who exactly I was altogether. So I will try not to keep you here that long, but I have some things that I would like to share with you. Since I have come a long way to be here, across the ocean from Eretz Yisrael, so I want to give you a little bit of an understanding of Eretz Yisrael's relevance to you, who don't live there. Yitz Hashem, one day we all will live there, including Dr. Lukens. But for the time being, Klal Yisrael are still in Golis, and we are mandated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to live all over the world, and all Jews can't return to Eretz Yisrael now. But even if you can't live in Eretz Yisrael, you should understand the significance of Eretz Yisrael. What you are doing here now is very much part and parcel of that significance. The Chaim Mivolozhin tells us that Avraham Avinu went through 10 tests. They weren't just individual personal tests for our forefather Avraham, but they created the reservoir of strength and power that all Jews have to function in similar situations throughout history. If Avraham Avinu had never been willing to sacrifice his only child for the sake of the Ribbono Shel Olam, then no Jew in history would ever have been able to sacrifice his life and the life of his family, Al Kiddush Hashem, for the sanctification of God's name. Where did we get that strength? Where did Jews throughout history get the strength to sacrifice themselves in many, many ways, till the point of sacrificing their very lives, only because Avraham Avinu created that reservoir of strength from which we draw the power to follow and emulate him? Similarly, he says, no Jew in history could ever pick himself up and leave familiar surroundings, friendly environment, family and friends, and ascend to Eretz Yisrael, make Aliyah, if it wasn't that Avraham Avinu did the same thing many, many years ago. So if we want to get a perspective on Eretz Yisrael and what it means, what the challenge of Eretz Yisrael is, not only for people who live there, but all Jews world over, who set their eyes on Eretz Yisrael at least 3 times a day. So it's important to understand what the test of Lech Lecha was. It's one of the tests of Avraham Avinu. But I don't understand what kind of test that was. God tells Avraham Avinu, Lech Lecha, go, and Rashi says, L'tovoscha u'lahanoscha, for your good and your pleasure. So God is promising that if Avraham Avinu makes this move, it's going to be for his good and his pleasure. There are many things in this world that are good for you, but they are not pleasurable. I always knew that if my mother, Olea Shalom, said, eat your vegetables, they're good for you, that they didn't taste good. She wouldn't have not had to revert to that, that it's good for me if it tasted good. So there are many things in this world that are good for you, but they're not pleasurable. There are many things in this world that are pleasurable and they're not good for you. HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises Avraham Avinu, if you go to Eretz Yisrael, I promise you, it's going to be good for you and pleasurable. What's the test? If God came to me tonight and said, move to Timbuktu, and I promise you, it's going to be good and pleasurable, why wouldn't I go? Talking about God Himself, who can make well on His promise. Yeah? You have an answer? Maybe, but the Rambam says that when a prophet receives prophecy, he has no doubts about it. I never had God speak to me directly, except through the Torah, and that happens sometimes when I have a chance to open a sefer. The Ribbono Shel Olam does speak to all of us, but as a prophet, I never had the Ribbono Shel Olam speak to me. But the Rambam says that when a prophet receives prophecy, he knows he hasn't lost it. He knows that God is speaking to him. So if tonight I would receive a prophecy like Avraham Avinu did, and know for sure that the other side of the conversation is God Himself, I have no doubts. So what's the test? Beyond that, Torah seems to be very difficult in describing how Avraham Avinu went about fulfilling this test. Torah says, as soon as God told him to go, Vayelech Avraham, Avraham Avinu went, Vayikach ito Lot, he took Lot, his nephew, with him. Avraham ben Shivim v'chamesh shana v'tzeiso mi'charon, and Avraham was 75 years old when he left Choron. Next sentence. Vayikach Avraham es Sara ishto, v'es Lot ben Ochi, v'et kol rechushom asher ochoshu, v'es hanefesh asher osu b'choron, v'yeitzu l'oleches arzo kenon. Avraham Avinu took his wife Sarai and his nephew Lot and all of his disciples and all of his property, and they left to go to Eretz Kenai. What's difficult? How many times did he leave? Said already he left. Said he took his nephew Lot and he left. Next sentence, he took his wife Sarai, he took Lot, and he left. Why? Twice. Very difficult to say that Avraham Avinu left the first time with Lot. And while they were on the journey, Avraham said, I don't know, I forgot something. I can't put my finger on it. He left something back there. And then it hit him. Sarah! Ran back, got Sarah. Not reasonable. So why does the Torah say that he left twice? And only the second time he took Sarah? It is obvious from the order that God gives Avraham Avinu in how to leave, that he's not asking him to make a geographic change alone, but to make an ideological change, a change of perspective, a change of values and standards and goals. Lech lecha me'artzecha u'mimoladetecha u'mibeis avicha. Go from your land, your birthplace, and your father's home. If we're talking about geography, we're talking about moving from a place, where do you leave first? You leave your father's home. Then you leave your city. Then you leave the country. But you don't leave the country before you leave your father's house. So why did God invert the order? First leave your country, then your birthplace, then your father's house. The answer is the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted Avraham Avinu not only to change his location, but to change his whole lifestyle. And therefore, it's easier to change the nebulous general ideas of your country, much more difficult your birthplace, and most difficult your father's home. So Avraham Avinu was told, I want you to leave the standards and values and ideals and mores of your country, more so your birthplace, and even of your own father's home. Because of that, Avraham Avinu first left physically. And if Avraham Avinu left, the Torah doesn't have to tell us that he took his wife Sarai, because Avraham and Sarai are one person. Ishto kegufo, bau keishto, a husband and wife, are two bodies in one person. So when it says, Vayelech Avraham, it means Sarai went with him. And of course it means that his students went with him. But Avraham Avinu abandoned his disciples, abandoned his students, so they're also included in Avraham. A Rebbe, his Talmidim, or his children. So of course he took his children with him. The Torah doesn't have to tell me that. When the Torah says Avraham went, it means his wife went and his children, his disciples went with him. And all of his property, he doesn't have to mention that either. You know what it has to mention? That he took his nephew Lot. That isn't understood. So the Torah had to tell me that when Avraham Avinu left, he took Lot also with him. Not only did he take everything that was part and parcel of his being, he also took Lot, his nephew. The second pasuk tells me something else. Now they're all on that journey to change their physical location from Haran to Eretz Yisrael. Rashi, many times in Chumash, says, whenever it says, Vayikach, someone took another human being, it doesn't mean by the hand. It means by the heart. They convinced them. You can't take a human being physically, because it's only his body. Taking another human being means to convince them to take them by the mind, by the heart. Once they're on the journey, the Torah tells us, Vayikach Avraham es Sarah ishto. Avraham gathered his family together. And he said, the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't want us only to change our location. He wants us to get new ideas, new ideals, new values and standards and goals. So he sat and he spoke to them. He gave them a shiur. And he convinced them of how to have different outlooks on life than they had in Haran, in preparation for what Eretz Yisrael is all about. And that was the test. They say that Rabbi Nachum Mendel Mivitebsk, famous Hasidic leader, who left Europe about 150 years ago to come to Eretz Yisrael, 40 days after he came to Eretz Yisrael, he made a tremendous party for his students. And when they asked him what the reason for the party was, he told them the following. He said, before I left Europe, a great Kabbalist told me that when I get to Eretz Yisrael, I will see that every rock in Eretz Yisrael is a diamond. And when I came off the ship, I saw plenty of rocks. I didn't see any diamonds. I didn't see diamonds on people's fingers, let alone on the ground. And I fasted for 40 days, day after day after day, eating only at night for the last 40 days. This morning was the end of my 40-day fast, and I opened the shutters, and I looked outside, and I saw that every rock in Eretz Yisrael is a diamond. Depends on your perspective. If you have the right view, if you have the right worldview, then Eretz Yisrael is a diamond. Then Eretz Yisrael is good for you, and Eretz Yisrael is pleasurable to you. If you have the wrong standards and the wrong values, then every rock in Eretz Yisrael is a stumbling block. It's not good, and it's not pleasurable. You need to have the right vision to be able to see that Eretz Yisrael is good and pleasurable. And that vision is something that even if you don't live in Eretz Yisrael, but that's the vision that a Jew has to have. And let me elaborate a little bit, give you maybe two examples of how Eretz Yisrael vision, what kind of lenses you have to wear, and it's more than lenses, it's even more than contact lenses, it's eye surgery. It has to be part of your essence, not something that you wear, not something that's just on you, something that's part of you. And this is how a Jew has to look at the world. And if a Jew looks at the world the way he's supposed to, then Eretz Yisrael is a desirable place. It's good, and it's pleasurable, and if you can't be there, and there are many reasons why many people can't be there now, halachically, justifiably, but at least the person feels bad. And when he says, "Sechezeno einenu b'shuvcha l'tzion," he means it. And there's a tear in his eye. And if you don't have that Torah vision, then Eretz Yisrael is meaningless. Eretz Yisrael is the opposite of pleasurable and the opposite of good for such a person. And that kind of person doesn't have an inkling about what Yarchei Kala is and what Torah is all about. God tells us on our way to Eretz Yisrael, we left Egypt, we're on the way to this unknown land, we haven't been there for 210 years, people were born in Golis, they never saw Eretz Yisrael. So God wants to encourage the Jewish people. And as a good salesman wants to sell Eretz Yisrael to the Jewish people. So you know what he tells us? He tells us the following. The land that I'm bringing you to is not like the land of Egypt. How so? Because the land of Egypt, whenever you needed water for irrigation, for drinking, you had the Nile. The Nile would overflow like clockwork. cyclical overflowings of the Nile. And you just took the water, you made little furrows, and you irrigated your fields. You always had a ready supply of water in the Mitzrayim. But the land I'm bringing you to, Lintara Shamayim Kishtemayim, it's a land of hills and mountains. There is no natural irrigation. And if it doesn't rain, there's no water. I don't know. God doesn't sound like a great salesman to me. I heard that. I'd say, you know what? Let's go back to Egypt. Egypt's great. There's always water available. Eretz Yisrael, can't promise you anything. It rains, doesn't rain. You're up the creek without a creek. What's the Rebbe Shlomo telling us? Tell you another thing that always bothered me. Remember the Nachash, the original snake, who wasn't the kind of snake that you see slithering on the ground these days. That snake was the epitome of animal life. One notch less than a human being. Walked on two legs. It's very, very intelligent. I always picture the snake. You ever see the monogram of Planters Peanuts? Mr. Peanut with the monocle. That's how I picture the original snake. That snake was cursed. You want to hear what its curse was? One of the curses that snake got was, "Va'ofer tochal kol yimei chayecha." You will eat dust all of your life. Now everyone knows that snakes don't eat dust. Because if they would only eat dust, they would die of malnutrition. So the rabbis say, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that snakes eat dust. What it means is, say the rabbis, that your food supply will be readily available to you wherever you are at any point in history, as the dust of the earth is readily available. You will never be missing food. It'll always be there for you, just like the dust of the earth. Now maybe I'm missing something, but that doesn't sound like a great curse. I wouldn't mind a curse like that. No shopping, your refrigerator will fill up with food whenever you need it, and if you don't need it, always going to be available. I wouldn't even mind a curse like that. Now I'll tell you of a blessing that the Jewish people got. You want to hear a blessing? When we were in the desert, so the manna, the mon, fell once a day. And if you wanted to save some for the next day, you couldn't. It rotted. One day's food supply. One day. Couldn't save for the next day. And if it didn't rain down mon the next day, you don't have anything to eat. That was a tremendous blessing. Now maybe I am missing something, but I think I would rather the curse than the blessing. So what's going on over here? So let me tell you what I think, where I learned the answer to this from an incident that happened when I was a rabbi in Miami. One of my congregants was a teacher in the local high school, secular high school. She taught Hebrew, so she had many Jewish students. She called me one day and she said, "Rabbi, I have a 16, 17-year-old boy who has already tried to commit suicide 3 times. Nobody can speak to him and get to him. Will you try?" I said, "Of course, bring him in and we'll see what we can do." She brings me this young man. I take one look at him. I never saw a sadder face in my life. I checked to see that maybe the world had been destroyed that morning. I didn't know about it. Because that's what he looked like. He was the most sad-looking person, the most person I ever saw in my life. 17 years old. So I said to him, "Young man, what could be so terrible that you lived through that makes you look the way you do?" He said, "I'll tell you." Said, "My parents have been divorced for many years. I have not no connection to my mother. I've grown up with my father. My father is a very wealthy man. And he recently met a woman who he wants to marry. But the woman gave him a condition. She doesn't want a 17-year-old boy around the house cramping her style. So she gave my father a choice, her or me. And one day my father called me in, and out of his pocket he pulled a set of keys. And he said, "I have purchased for you a very expensive plush condominium in a very yuppie neighborhood in Miami. It's all paid for, fully furnished. Here are the keys. It's your bachelor pad." From the other pocket, he pulled out another set of keys. And he said, "These are keys to a very expensive, fancy sports car, which I have bought and paid for. You need transportation, use your car in good health." And from his wallet, he pulled out a credit card on his name. He said, "You need to eat, entertainment, clothing. I'm a very wealthy man. Within reason, whatever you want, feel free to put it on my bill. Use the credit card, the bill will come to me. Just one thing. It's nice knowing you. Have a good life. Don't call me. I won't call you. Don't come and visit. Enjoy the apartment, the car, and the credit card." I was much younger at the time. My first thought was, if I was 17 years old, and I had my own apartment, my own sports car, and my own unlimited credit, I do not think I would be on the verge of suicide. I think I'd be pretty happy. So I felt like telling this young man, look, we all have our package of suffering and misfortune in this world. So let's trade. You give me your package, I'll give you mine. You give me the car, the condominium, and the credit card, and I'll give you my Taurus. And then it hit me. Every time that young man lived in that apartment, sat in that furniture, used that car, and used that credit card, it reminded him that nobody wanted him. He was totally rejected. Nobody loved him. And that was the most depressing thing that could possibly be. He had everything except one thing, love. Except a parent that cared for him. And that's depressing. The Nachash, the Rabbanu Shlom told the Nachash, "I want to have nothing to do with you. There have to be snakes in the world. I'm going to supply your food supply till the end of time, but I want to have nothing to do with you. It's all there for you. Wherever you go, it'll be there. Don't bother me, I won't bother you." The Jewish people in the desert, the Rabbanu Shlom said, "I'm not going to give you more than one day's food supply, so every day you know you have a loving father who wants to provide food for you. Every day you'll come and know that I care." That's a bracha. The Nachash got a klal. Eretz Yisrael doesn't have a ready water supply. Egypt, God said, "I'm putting on a Shabbos clock. We'll set it up ahead of time. By natural cycles, the Nile River will overflow. You'll have your water, just don't have anything to do with me. I'm not interested in having a personal relationship with you." But Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Asher Eini Hashem Elokecha Bo, Mereishis Hashana Barach Rishana. It's a land that has an intimate, close, ongoing relationship with God. That's a bracha. There may not be as much water, but you know that if you're getting water, you're getting it because God wants to give it to you. And if He doesn't want to give it to you, there's a reason. And it's not because He doesn't love you. It's because He loves you and cares for you so much that He wants you to act properly, and He's willing to withhold the water to make you act properly. So it depends on your vision. If your vision of this world is, how much water can I have? How much food can I have? Condominiums, credit, cars, that's what's important, then Eretz Yisrael may not be good and it may not be pleasurable. But if your view of this world is what's important to me, kirvat Hashem, li tov, what I consider good is having a relationship with my Father in heaven. That's what's important to me. And Eretz Yisrael is very good, and Eretz Yisrael is very pleasurable. Tell you another, one more aspect of how one, if he has the right perspective, sees things much differently than if he has the wrong perspective. Before Avraham Avinu was commanded to settle in Eretz Yisrael, so he went on a pilot trip. He took a tour around the world to see if he could find a place that he felt was conducive for the children that he had emunah and bitachon that one day he would have. So he came to Aram Naharaim in Chutz Laaretz, and he saw a bunch of idol worshippers eating and drinking and partying. And he said, God, please, this is not the land that I want you to give me for myself and for my children. Please, don't give me this land. And then he came to Eretz Israel, Eretz Canaan, and he saw a bunch of idol worshippers planting, plowing, harvesting, and he said, God, this is the place. This is the place I want for my children. Now, at first glance, I live on a moshav in Eretz Israel. I guess I could handle the fact that this medrash is telling me that agriculture is a very important thing. What was Avraham Avinu inspired with? Here's a bunch of idol worshippers eating, drinking, and partying. Here's a bunch of idol worshippers working the land. Bunch of idol worshippers working the land. That's something special. But the truth is, in Judaism, we have Shlosha Tzrei Ikarim, the 13 principles of faith. But they're spelled with an ayin and a kuf, not an aleph and a chaf. Ikarim with an aleph and a chaf means farmers. We don't have 13 farmers. We have 13 principles of faith. So what's the ideal for you? What was Avraham Avinu so inspired with a bunch of idol worshippers planting, plowing, and harvesting, as opposed to a bunch of idol worshippers eating, drinking, and partying? Tell you what I think. There are two divergent philosophies of life. There is what is basically a secular philosophy of life, and there's a Torah philosophy of life. The secular philosophy of life has many, many different approaches, but bottom line, they're all the same thing. What is that? I saw it once condensed on a t-shirt in one sentence. What is the philosophy of life of the secular world? The one who has the most toys wins. What does that mean? When you're young, the toys are small. When you get bigger, the toys get bigger. Toys are things that bring you pleasure. You're born, you have a certain amount of time to live till you die, and the purpose of life is to amass toys. And the one who has the most toys, when he dies, wins the game. To some people, toys are very crass, unrefined. To some people, toys are very refined. Toys could be culture, opera, literature. They could even be doing good for other people. But bottom line, you know why I do good for other people? Because I get pleasure out of it. It makes me happy. So it's a refined toy. But basically, life is all about fulfilling yourself and filling yourself and enjoying yourself. And that's what you were put in this world to do. Enjoy yourself. Immediate gratification. Now. Immediate. The more toys, the more success. I knew of a woman from L.A. many years ago who was buried in her Rolls Royce. She obviously won. She had the most toys. She was even buried in the toy. What exactly she gained from that, I'm not sure. I'm sure that her gas mileage at that point was great. But beyond that, I'm not exactly sure what she benefited. But she won. Doesn't say exactly what you win, but she won. She had a successful life. She had the most toys on the block. If that's all that life is, then let me tell you something very depressing. But don't get depressed, because this is not what life is at all. But if that's what life is, then we can describe life in the following depressing, dismal way. Imagine a man standing outside the delivery room, waiting for news of his wife's impending birth. And the doctor comes out and says, "I have very sad news for you. Your wife gave birth to a baby, but the baby was born with a mortal disease from which it cannot survive. Your baby's going to die of this terrible disease that it was born with." The father says to the doctor, "Doctor, give me some hope. There's a cure." "No." "You're looking for a cure." "Nah, we gave up long ago." "Someone survived this disease miraculously without a cure." "Never, not in the annals of medical history." The man says to the doctor, "I never heard of such a terrible disease. No one has survived. There is no cure. You're not looking for a cure. What is the name of this terrible disease that my child was born with?" The doctor tells him, "You see, when your child was born, he contracted the disease we call life. Some people have survived 80 years, 90 years, 100 years, 120 years, but one thing is for sure. Whoever is born and contracts the disease called life eventually succumbs to it. Eventually it does them in." You're born, imagine if you would know how many seconds you're going to live. Let's say you're going to live 120. So multiply that by 365. Multiply that by 24. Multiply that by 60. Multiply that by 60. And multiply that by 60. And you will have the amount of seconds in 120 years. Very big number. Take that big number and put it on a digital display in the delivery room and push the button the moment that you are born. What happens? The numbers start to go down. By the time they get you out of the delivery room, hundreds of numbers have already gone down. You're sitting here now, the numbers are going by faster and faster. If that's all that life is, then what the rabbis describe the life of a wicked person, Rishoyim b'chayehem nikroyim mesim, wicked people in their lifetime are called dead, but that's not really the translation. They're not dead. They're dying. Mesim. Why are they dying? Because that's what happens. Thank you. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam shehakol nehiyah b'dvaro. They're born and they begin to die. Life is a long, debilitating disease, if that's your outlook on life. Our outlook on life is completely different. We don't start to live when we're born, and we don't cease to live when we die. We began to live when we were created as souls. We are not bodies with little Casper the Friendly Ghost flitting inside of us. That's called the soul. We are souls. That's what we were in the spiritual world for many thousands of years before we came into this physical world. And one day the Rav Amram decided for each of us that that neshama, that's us, had to come into this physical world. Except the neshama can't exist in a physical world without a spacesuit. An astronaut, as long as he's on the earth, can function very nicely without any apparatus, without any special clothing. He goes into outer space, he has to put on a suit that's pressurized, that provides him with oxygen, that provides him with a means of talking through a radio, because there is no airwaves in outer space. When he comes back to Earth, he takes off the suit. As long as we as souls lived in a spiritual world, we could function very nicely without a body. We could see without eyes and hear without ears and get around without arms and legs. But once we as souls came into this physical world, we needed an inner space suit called a body to be able to function in this physical world. When we leave this world, we leave the body here, just like the astronaut takes off his space suit. And that's one of the reasons why when someone dies, the way that we express our mourning is by tearing our clothing. to show that it's only the clothing that's been torn away, but the essence of the person still exists. So why are we doing in this world? Why did God take our souls from such a lofty place in a spiritual world, put us down in this physical world, only to go back to where we were? So the rabbis tell us, because God wanted to shower His goodness on us and give us the ultimate pleasure. The ultimate pleasure is an eternal relationship with Him. That's what we call the world to come. But God wanted us to appreciate that to the utmost. So He wanted us to earn it. So He put our souls in a physical world, distanced from Him, and He said, you create the relationship with me, I'm not going to create the relationship with you. And He gave us rules, and He gave us guidelines, and He gave us instruction called the Torah. And the Torah not only deals with us, but deals with the whole world. Every human being is instructed in the Torah in different ways. Kohanim have their way, Levim their way, Israel in their way, non-Jews their way, men their way, women their way. Everybody is instructed by the Torah how to earn that eternal reward. And therefore, life, from that standpoint, is infinitely valuable. Life in this world, every second is eternity. Because every second a person can create more and more of that eternity if he lives his life properly. Everything a person does, eats, drinks, political, commercial, social, married life, school life, everything you do can be done in a way that brings you closer to God, that makes you more God-like, that makes you then fit to have that eternal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or it can be done in a way that distances you from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what this world is all about. The Gemara says there was a man who committed terrible sins, and then he repented in a very intense way. And he repented so intensely that he died. And a heavenly voice resounded, Ashrecha Reb Eliezer ben Durdoi, shemesukin hu la'olam haba. That with his repentance, that 1 second before he died, that he repented intensely, got him a share in the world to come. When Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the one who compiled the Mishnah, heard about this, he cried. And he said, Yeshkono lama b'sha'achas, a person can acquire his share in the world to come in 1 second. So the Telzer Rosh Yeshiva asks, what was Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi crying about? It bothered him that this guy got his Olam Haba in 1 second, and it took him a lifetime. I'm sure that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's lifetime of Olam Haba was greater than that 1 second Olam Haba. What did it bother Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi? He cried. He said, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was crying over the fact that it became obvious that you can do that every second. It's not just a one-time thing. Every second a person can acquire eternity on every level of life. According to the first value of life, life isn't intrinsically valuable. Because if life is how many toys you can have, how much enjoyment you can have in this world, then what if you're in a coma? How many steaks can you eat in a coma? None. How many movies can you see? None. What can you do already? Lie there in a coma. What kind of life is that? Pull the plug. Make room for somebody else. Just using up the taxpayers' money. A young person with all his teeth can hear, can see. That's a life. Person's 98 years old, no teeth, can't eat, can't hear, barely see, can't get around. What kind of life is that? There's no intrinsic value to life. But from our standpoint, a person in a coma has a very valuable life. Every second of life is valuable. What can that person do? Can think. And even if the EEG machine says that there's no brain waves, that doesn't mean he's not thinking. That means that the machine can't pick up brain activity. Doesn't mean there isn't any. Maybe in 10 years they'll find a more sensitive machine and they'll decide that the guy really had brain activity. We're sorry we pulled the plug. We'll make it up to you somehow. And maybe there'll be never a machine that will be able to be sensitive enough, not that that person's brain is working, but his neshama is working. And as long as his neshama hasn't separated from his body, what his neshama thinks affects his eternal reward. So we can think, big deal. But you know that there are mitzvahs that you can achieve just by thinking? Love of God, fear of God, belief in God. They're all mitzvahs that are just with thought. But even more than that. The rabbis say that if a person wants to do a mitzvah, but he can't, because physically he can't do it, he gets rewarded as if he did it. That person can do more mitzvahs than a person who's functional. Because if he can think about all the mitzvahs, he gets rewarded as if he did them. And somebody who can function only gets rewarded for what he does. A person can do tshuva. He can affect eternity. 1 second of life is in eternally intrinsically valuable. That's how valuable life is to us. We're the ones who value this world. Religious people value this world, not just the next world, because there is no next world without this world. As the Meiri says, one of the commentaries on the Talmud, the Menachem HaMeiri, he says, Olam Haba hu pri ha'olam hazeh. Olam Haba is the fruit of this world. There's not two different worlds. Here is where Hazorin Bedima, you plant, and sometimes with tears. Berina Yiktsoru, there you pluck the fruit. This world is a world where you put in effort. You can enjoy the effort. But this world is not a place for immediate gratification. You put in the effort, in the next world you reap the profits. Secular view of the world is, we want it now. Avraham Avinu saw that Eretz Israel was conducive to the kind of lifestyle that Yaakov Avinu represented by his occupation. Yaakov Avinu was a shepherd. A shepherd raises a sheep when he can't do anything for him for a future benefit of milk and wool and meat from that sheep when it matures. But he puts a lot of work into it until then. What was Esav? Esav was a hunter. A hunter doesn't want to know from the animal until he can benefit from it. He wants to walk into the forest, shoot a mature animal, eat it on the spot. That's the difference between Yaakov and Esav. That's the difference between a Torah outlook on life and a non-Torah outlook on life. Are you looking for immediate gratification in this world? Or are you willing to put in effort and invest for an eternal future? And then life in this world is part of that eternal future. It's part and parcel of it. It's the seeds that eventually will grow in to those fruits. That's what Avraham Avinu saw. Eretz Israel is conducive, even by goyim, even by idol worshippers, for an idea of putting in effort now for a future goal. Okay, their future goal is the fruit in this world. My children will extend it to the next world. Chutz La'aretz, outside of Eretz Israel, is conducive for eating, drinking, and partying. That doesn't mean you can't live a fine Torah life here outside of Eretz Israel, but you have to fight against the environmental influence. It's there, it's in the air, it's in the ground. And doesn't mean you can't live a lifestyle, the antithesis of Torah in Eretz Israel. Believe me, there are plenty of people who do it. But you have to fight against the environmental influence there too. There it's in the air, it's in the ground, the proper hashkata. You want to go against it, you can. But you have to fight against it. Here, you can live a Torah life, but you have to fight against the environment. So if you have the right glasses, you have the right lenses, you have the right outlook, ideas, then you'll see that Eretz Israel is a pleasurable and good place. And if you don't, Eretz Israel is a Gehenna. It's not pleasurable and it's not good. That was Avraham Avinu's test. Would he be able to set his values and standards and ideals and outlooks on this world properly? Or would he not be able to, and therefore not be able to see Eretz Israel in its proper light? We are beginning this week Sefer Shmos. We all look forward to the Geula, to the ultimate redemption of the world. So let me tell you two things about that redemption. One is how we can bring that redemption about, and until that happens, how we have to live here in Golis. Every book of the Torah has two names. The name that's taken from the first or second or third word of the Sefer, Bereishis, Shmos, Vayikra, Bamidbar, Dvarim. There's another name though. The rabbis gave each of these books the thematic name of the book. Bereishis is called Sefer HaYetzirah, the book of creation. Shmos, as it says on the pamphlet that I saw there, is called Sefer HaGeula, the book of redemption. Vayikra is called Toras Kohanim, the laws of the Kohanim. Bamidbar is called Chumash HaPikudim, the Chumash of the senses. And Devarim is called Mishneh Torah. Those are the names, you know these names. You may not know them in Hebrew or in English, but you know them in Greek. Because those are the names that the Greeks gave these Sfarim when the Torah was translated to Greek. Genesis, Sefer HaYetzirah. Exodus, Sefer HaGeulah. Leviticus, Toras Kohanim. Leviticus means the laws of the Levites, of the Kohanim. Bamidbar is Numbers. What in the world does desert have to do with numbers? But that's the name of the Sefer, Chumash HaPikudim. The Chumash of the numbering of the Jewish people when they went into the desert and they came out of the desert. Mishneh Torah is Deuteronomy. The review of the law is Mishneh Torah. So the Greeks knew these names that the Chachamim gave the Sfarim, and they used those names as the Greek names of the Sefer. All the names correspond, the two names of each Sefer correspond to each other beautifully, except Sefer Shmos. Bereishis, in the beginning, the book of creation, fits beautifully. Vayikra, God called to Moshe from the Mishkan, and he told him the laws of the Kohanim. Beautiful. Bamidbar, everything that happened in the desert, between the counting that they went into the desert, the counting when they came out of the desert. So in the desert, between the countings. Devarim, these are the words that Moshe said in parting with the Jewish people. What did he tell them? A review of the Torah, Mishneh Torah. What in the world is Shmos? Names have to do with the Geula, with redemption. Book of names, book of redemption. Doesn't seem to be any connection. Yet Rashi says, the Eila Shmos B'nei Yisrael Malamei Chibosam L'fnei Amakom. How precious we are before God, that God calls every Jew by name, like he calls the stars by name. Every star has a name. And God counts them and calls them by name. It's a big deal. Every star has a name. What in the world does that mean? I'll tell you, I was here a few years ago, this time of year. I came back a few years after that, also this time of year, and I'm waiting this time to hear it again. On the radio, I heard the following advertisement. In case you have a friend who has everything, which here in America is possible, and you have a trouble to find what present you're going to give him now during this time of giving presents amongst the nations of the world. So we have a good possibility for you. We have some good advice. If you will send, about 8 years ago it was $25, 3 years ago it was $50 already, I'm sure it's up to $75. You'll send $25 to the following address. We will name a star in the name of the person you want to give the present. We will send him a document, a scroll, a certificate, attesting to that, and we will record it in the star registry that this star is named in his name, all for $25. Let me tell you something. There is no official book called the Star Registry. I can take a notebook, write on the outside, Star Registry, and go outside and name every star in the heavens in my name. All of them, and write it down in my Star Registry. It has exactly as much meaning as their star registry. And I write myself a certificate. This certifies that every name has been called by me on my name. That's what it means. God calls every star a name. Big deal. The rabbis tell us a name represents a person's abilities, capabilities, and talents. It's your essence. It's what you are. Every one of us has four names, the rabbis say. The name God gives you, the name your parents give you, the name your friends give you, and the most important one is the one you give yourself. What does it mean? I'll tell you what I think it means. Every one of us, without exception, has abilities, capabilities, and talents. Some of them are directly given to us by God. When God created our soul, He made us unique because we have something to accomplish in this world, and God equipped us to accomplish it. So that's the name that God gives you. Those are the qualities that God gives you directly. Some qualities we have, talents, abilities, capabilities, come from heredity. That's the name your parents give you. Some come from the environment, from what you learn from your friends, what other people teach you, and develop various talents, abilities, and capabilities. That's the name your friends give you. All of that is potential. What is the real name? The one that you develop. From all that potential, what you actually realize, that's the name you give yourself. Where is the geula? Where is the redemption? Redemption means that the world will reach perfection. It'll be fulfilled. All the potential will be realized. You know how the world realizes potential? When each and every individual realizes their potential. When you bring out that God-given potential, those abilities, capabilities, and talents that God gives you, and you use it somehow in service of the Ribono Shel Olam, of Klal Yisrael, of Torah, in service of God and the Jewish people and His Torah, then that brings the Geula. It's a beautiful story. This is not a chazal, but I once heard in a graduation. A man was reading a magazine, and his little five-year-old son was bothering him incessantly. He couldn't get a minute to make headway in this magazine. So he saw that one page in the magazine was a map of the world. So he tore out the page, tore it into 20 little pieces, called his son in, and he said, "Here's a puzzle. It's a map of the world. Go put it together and don't come back till you finish." He figured the kid's 5 years old. He has no idea what the picture of the map of the world looked like. So he's going to have to put it together by matching the contours of the tears. It's going to take him hours. I have a few hours now, peace and quiet. Kept the kid busy. 15 minutes later, the young boy comes back. Says, "Daddy, I finished it. The page is back the way it was when you gave it, before you tore it up." Father says, "Impossible. If you knew what the world looked like, what the map of the world looked like, you could have put it together in 15 minutes. But you have no idea what the world looks like. You had to match the tears. You couldn't do it in 15 minutes. He says, "Come and see." And sure enough, on the glass top of its coffee table, the world is reconstructed 100%. The map is perfect. Father says, "Why? You're a genius. At 5 years old, you must have known what the picture looked like." He says, "No, it's very easy. You see, on the other side of the paper was a picture of a man. I just put the man together and the whole world fell into place." That's how you make the world fall into place. You put yourselves together. You develop your talents, abilities, and capabilities, and that will bring the Geula. You know where the Geula is? In your names. In the names of Bnei Yisrael. That's Sefer HaGeula. That's the book of redemption. That's where the redemption is. You have, each and every one of you, have a mission in this world. You have tremendous potential. Tremendous potential. You may not even realize what it is. Develop it. And the way for a Jew to develop it is by learning Torah. When you learn Torah, you learn about yourself. And you learn what you can do. And you learn how to do it properly. And you will help to bring that geula, that redemption to the world. But until that happens, and this with this I'm going to conclude. So how do we survive until that geula comes? So there is a medrash that says the following. L'mishpichoseihem yotzu min ha-teva. Noach and his family left the teva, they left the ark, family by family. Mikan, says the medrash, from here we learn a lesson. Kishiyotzi min ha-beis ha-knesses, Yotze mishpachas mishpachas. When you leave shul, you should leave by family. We don't have the family that prays together, stays together. We daven separately, men and women. But when you leave the shul, you should leave by family. What's the simple meaning? The word teva means a ship, Noah's ark. But in Mishnaic Hebrew, teva also meant the Aron HaKodesh, the holy ark. In English, it's still preserved like that. The place where we put the Sefer Torah is called the holy ark, similar to Noah's ark. So with a play on words, when they left the ark, they left by family. When you leave the ark, leave by family. When you leave the shul, leave the Aron HaKodesh. Leave the ark, leave by family. Very nice. What does it mean? Say what it means. We live in a world that until that redemption comes, we are engulfed by a marble, by a flood, a very dangerous, polluted water. And to survive, we have to somehow insulate ourselves from that flood that surrounds us, from those torrid, polluted waters. So how do you do it? What is the ship? What's the boat that keeps out that flood? Bate kinesios, bate medrashos. Shuls, yeshivas. Places of learning for women. Those are the tevas. Those are the places of refuge that keep out the waters from inundating us, from drowning us. You can't spend your whole life, though, in a shul. You can't even spend your whole life within the walls of a Beis Nevesh. You have to, at some point, and at some times, go out of those walls. How do you survive, then, when you leave the teva? Says the Medrash, L'mishpich hoseihem yatzu min ha-teva. If you take the standards and values and ideals that you are inspired with in the shul, and that you learn in the yeshiva, in the Beis Medrash, with you, and you make them the standards and values and outlooks of your home, of your family, that even when you leave the shul and you leave the Beis Medrash, you can leave and still be protected if you leave by family, if you have a family to protect you. That's what you have to do. You have to learn the Yarchei Kalash and whet your appetite to learn and learn and learn and go on to higher learning and to be inspired from everything that a shul represents, tila, avodas Hashem. And then take all of that and create Torah families. Families where you will make the ideals and ideas and standards and values of your family, of your home, equal, parallel to those values and standards that shuls, that yeshivas stand for. And the truth is, Chazal say, that as long as we can't all be in Eretz Yisrael, as long as the Geula hasn't come, as long as that perfection hasn't come to the world, then Chutz La'aretz, it's here. Bate Knesios, Bate Medrashos, the shuls, the yeshivas, that's Eretz Yisrael. Because Eretz Yisrael is not just a place. Ultimately, ideally, it's a certain geographic location. But it's more than that. It's a way of life. It's standards, it's values, it's an outlook on life, it's a perspective on life. And if you create that perspective here, you may not have the ideal, and if you can have the ideal, and until you have the ideal, feel that you're missing something. But as long as the ideal can be, then at least create that spiritual Eretz Yisrael, the right perspective of life, everywhere that you are, anywhere in the world, can be spiritually the right outlook of Eretz Yisrael. And that will help to pave the way that one day all Jews will return to Eretz Yisrael on that great day when HaKadosh Baruch Hu will blow that great shofar and send us Eliyahu HaNavi to tell us that Mashiach is here, that all Jews can now rise up from this bitter Golus and return to Eretz Israel, not only in spirit, but in body also. And hail the Yomeinu soon in our days.